incredibly humiliating and terrifying for Russia and Saudi Arabia to have these oil prices regardless. But to have these oil prices in the context of the Red Sea being bombed, genocide in Palestine, and a daily risk of broader war between the United States and Iran, wiping out, you know, potentially wiping out all Gulf oil production, to have these prices in that context is just like, wow. The China shock oil market is dead.
Hello and welcome to the More Freedom Foundation podcast. And as we say every time, season's greetings to you all, Anglo-Saxon friends, and their happy oinking piglets. Isn't that right, Rob? Happy oinking.
Yes, indeed, indeed. Gotta look out for those Anglo-Saxons and their happy oinking piglets. Let's hear it for the guy who really, really knows the appropriate way to wish people a Merry Christmas or what have you.
Yes.
Dmitry Medvedev.
Mm-hmm. Who I would always see as the second most powerful man in Russia and used to be the president for one term.
He was sort of Vladimir Putin's beard.
Okay.
That's sort of one way to talk about him. But the guy who was supposedly in power when Vladimir Putin decided he would pay attention to the Constitution and not have the official main power in Russia. Some would argue that Putin was actually trying to give up power, but he certainly didn't.
Well, I've also heard that it's possible that Putin sort of, he doesn't have nearly as much power as we give him credit for, because I think it feeds into the sort of Western narrative that there's just a lot of competing factions in Russia, and I guess maybe they were possibly going to end him. So he's kind of like a weird ringleader that tries to keep them all happy and does his best. So maybe it had a lot of these higher-ups didn't want to have so much scrutiny on them and kept him as a puppet, but who knows?
Who knows? Regardless, Dmitry Medvedev, a former president of Russia, right?
Yes.
Or was he prime?
Was he prime minister?
He's been both. He's been both.
Okay.
Former leader of Russia doesn't really have much to do, so he's decided to distinguish himself as an English language online troll. And about a year ago, at this point, he issued a series of quite ambitious predictions of what 2023 would bring. And we thought that it might be, we did an episode in sort of the early days of this podcast where we went through those predictions and talked about what we thought may or may not happen with those predictions. And now a year later, we thought it might be fun, as sort of a belated holiday episode, to review those predictions and see how Dmitry did.
But also a way to look back at the past year as well.
Indeed. Indeed.
So one thing we did in the last episode that annoyed me is we didn't mention the first one soon enough, for my opinion. So oil price to rise to $150 a barrel and gas price will top 5,000 per 1,000 cubic meters. What's the gas like these days, Rob?
It is hovering in the 70s. For WTI and Brent, which is roughly half of what he had hoped the
average
price would be.
For 2023 was $83 per barrel. So yes, it didn't quite top his predictions.
What's kind of crazy is from the context of 2022, this is the sanest looking prediction that he makes in this Twitter thread. In 2022, Russia invaded Ukraine, and oil prices did briefly zoom up into the stratosphere. We did have prices of $120, I think even $130 a barrel at certain points. And there were plenty of people, I think by December of last year, I was losing any faith in this possibility, but there were plenty of people, real analysts, who could have seen 150. Actually, in fact, I think for most of the big banks and most sort of oil traders, the prediction for the first half of 2023 was that, okay, finally, markets are going to tighten back up again. And in the second half of 2023, we're not going to see $150 a barrel, but we're definitely going to see $100 a barrel. We're definitely going to see a real serious oil price spike. And wow, have we not. It's probably one of the more important developments of 2023, just the extent to which there has been no serious rebounding of oil prices.
And the other thing is the gas price as well. So to give an idea, I'm comparing it in United States dollars to British thermal units. So it rose to about just over $9 per million British thermal units, and it's now down at around about 2.8. So
Oh, wow. It's all the way back down there.
yes, it's pretty much down to kind of where it was 2021, way before any of this Ukrainian war happened.
Oh, so that is so sad. I mean, it's also the most important prediction for Medvedev and the Russian government.
Because they're more of a gas economy than an oil one.
Exactly. And just to see that what was kind of what they were leg probably legitimately hoping were fairly unambitious price goals have just, they look fantastical and silly, as the rest of this thread does, but not.
A lot more plausible.
It's the one that they cared about the most, and it has utterly, utterly failed. It's really worth saying this has been a tremendous failure for the Russian government, but for the Saudi government as well, really for any oil producer outside of the United States. The story of 2023 is just like, sorry, it's just not coming back. And I think I've emphasized this before in shorts and many other contexts, is but I think want to emphasize take the opportunity to emphasize again is that we are not going back to the China shock era.
No.
I think that unlike the oil crises of the 1970s, where okay, there were two really strong geopolitical events, Arab-Israeli War in 1973, and then the fall of the Shah in Iran in 1979, that brought big oil price spikes, and they were up for a year or two or whatnot, and then folks made the changes necessary to bring prices back down. In the first decade of this century, because of the China shock, because of the incredible, 10% a year growth in China consumption of everything that we saw through the 90s and into the 2000s, ending really in the aftermath of 2008 and very much ending by 2016, a whole generation of oil professionals, whether you're talking about people who staff state oil companies or Goldman Sachs oil traders or really anybody, became accustomed to a world that doesn't exist. They became accustomed to a fantasy world because China kept prices elevated for most of a decade, which really hadn't even happened in the 1970s. I mean, the 1970s sort of broke something, and it took us from an era where oil prices were low and stable forever into one where they were much less predictable. But the first decade of the century, China built a fantasy for generations of oil professionals that the natural price of oil and gas was just high, in ways that it just hasn't been since 2014. Specifically, the kinds of geopolitical events that broke the world oil market and sent it into this incredible volatility and much higher prices in the 1970s. We've been getting those level geopolitical events multiple times a year now. I mean, 2023, it would be incredibly humiliating and terrifying for Russia and Saudi Arabia to have these oil prices regardless, but to have these oil prices in the context of the Red Sea being bombed, a genocide in Palestine, and a daily risk of broader war between the United States and Iran, wiping out, potentially wiping out all Gulf oil production, to have these prices in that context is just like, wow. Like there's Like the oil market, the China shock oil market is dead. And it is quite stunning that most analysts, most journalists, most traders are still pretending like we're going to go back to the 2000s. And we're
And
just
it's well, it's
not.
the fact that China has been sort of not doing so great over the past year, which has meant it hasn't even sort of come back to, not necessarily it's the best times during the boom, but just sort of like it hasn't seemed to got back to just daily normal production. It's still kind of just struggling on, so that's kept oil prices somewhat low. I know everyone sort of thinks once China gets back to it, but it's possible this is the new China for the foreseeable future.
And even once China gets back to it, we're talking, 6 or 7% growth. We're not talking 10% growth. And China is doing everything it can. I think there's been a lot of news. That's probably something worth talking about in 2023. Just this, the China's big jump into the Middle East. They did a deal between Iran and Saudi Arabia, which I think we've talked about at great length. It's not something I have a lot of time for. But really, what China desperately wants to do is that they're happy to, if they can do it for cheap, they're happy to spoil U.S. relationships in the Middle East or what have you. But their main priority in the Middle East is getting out of there as much as humanly possible. Everything that they're doing, the electric vehicle rollout, the nuclear power rollout, just digging
Solar panels.
solar panels, continuing to dig as much coal as they possibly can. All of this is in a desperate 10-year sprint to get out of the Middle East. And which just makes it so farcical that everyone's like, oh, China's replacing the US. Like, why in God's name? What about what the US has been doing in the Middle East over the past 2 decades seems at all appealing or sounds like a fun or useful thing to do?
Especially when your economy isn't built around your military profiting from wars overseas.
Exactly. So yeah, it is not a not a thing. The Chinese infiltration in the Middle East and this idea that China is somehow going to, band together with Saudi Arabia and Iran to provide this huge challenge to the United States is, it's just, it's poppycock. It's because we have a, it's because we have a massive industry based around making money off of military action.
And that was the most plausible.
That was the most plausible of Medvedev's claims. Yes. Yes.
The UK will rejoin the EU. Not yet. It didn't
Not
happen.
yet.
Might
Not
happen in
yet.
2024, but as of yet, definitely a big year for not a lot happening on that front. The UK lost a lot of its big personalities as far as international politics goes. Rishi Sunak's basically biding time, trying to sell off as much of the UK and do the best amount of deals for his father-in-law, who's like one of the richest
Really?
men in India. Well,
Wow.
he's a very intelligent man, and he made about 200 million off his own bat, but he married even better. It was like the daughter of a giant telecoms company in India, so that makes him a billionaire and the richest UK politician in history.
Wow, okay.
So he's been doing some nice deals for his father-in-law, and then once this gig doesn't work out, he'll get his green card for America and probably teach at Harvard and that kind of thing.
The what was the, my favorite Rishi Sunak story? That was this year, right? Of
Yeah,
the
yeah.
year was Joe Biden goes to Ireland and has this thing, it's like the
Yes.
Super Bowl essentially. There's he's meeting every Irish politician and handshaking and spending weeks, and then he goes and meets Rishi Sunak in a diner in Northern Ireland or something along
Yes,
those lines. It's
it's
just sort of a,
quite dismal.
yeah. The I think it's been yet another year of sort of humiliation for post-Brexit Britain.
So
It's
I think because of that, it's basically seen as Brexit's done as much as it's going to get done. The idea will be kind of a lot of things will slowly add up if Labour get in, which is looking very likely currently. But mostly just the odd argument over something incredibly minor. That's basically there was like a big EU kind of scared by China's Belt and Road or whatever wants to have much better integration. So there was a map basically saying we're going to put a lot of money into the EU, and apparently people in the UK were annoyed that they weren't included. Because why would you if you're not part of the club anymore? So just lots of nothing stories like that, but nothing really much has been happening. Obviously, there's been a lot of help towards Ukraine, and but the UK is on because it's part of NATO, a lot of that crosses over. So in a lot of that capacity, which is what Dmitry would really want to suffer to break apart, the UK has been 100% behind all its other European allies in helping
Well,
Ukraine.
and most importantly, has been desperate to get Biden's attention and to look helpful. We've seen two great implementations of that just over the past month. The UK very eager to throw what little resources it has into defending the Red Sea from the Houthis, and Venezuela. Apparently, they sent a naval naval asset. Was it the HMS T something?
Okay.
To Guyana.
To protect its old territory and respect their independence, I guess they're going to argue.
Presumably, because the United States, said sure.
Maybe
why not?
Just to keep an eye on the Falklands, since what Argentina's up to.
I feel like the Falklands is a little distant from the Caribbean, but
I don't know.
My geography's not
over.
So great. You can pop over, indeed. I think that, at least under this conservative government, Britain's still desperately trying to court the United States with essentially nil results, as we talked about Biden meeting Sunak in a diner.
I think the country that he's visited the most is the UK, to be fair.
Really? Biden has visited the UK a lot?
Yeah, I think so. It might be possible that he stops off going to, say, Germany or something.
Mm-hmm.
He does a lot of quick ones, it seems.
Interesting.
And I think he was over, I guess, for the King's coronation.
Ah, yes. Really? He went to the King's? No, he didn't.
Did he not? No, okay.
Oh, I thought there was a big scandal that he didn't.
Okay.
Sorry, I don't like to be...
Well, double check. I seen a thing that's basically of all the countries he had visited that the most.
First Lady Jill Biden.
Okay.
Why Joe Biden isn't attending King Charles III's coronation. I think it is an American tradition. It hasn't been exercised for 70 years. But we don't go. No, we do not go to British coronations. We'll send somebody, but we do not send our presidents to worship at the feet of George III's successors. No, we do not do that. So, yeah. Sorry, as I may have communicated, I am a firm Republican, and obviously don't find British royalty as objectionable as I do, say, Saudi monarchy, but I am not a fan of it.
You're not going to vote for it.
No, I am certainly not going to do that, Ray.
Number three on the predictions list was the EU will collapse after the UK's return, euro will drop out of usage as... the former EU currency.
Mm-hmm. Well, that didn't happen.
Yes. Apparently, a lot of countries in the European Union are still using the euro. Everyone seems pretty happy. What is it? EU countries that use the euro, 69% of them believe that the euro is a good thing for their country. So, a bit of a nothing burger there. And... historically, the euro to the dollar hasn't really done much. I think it's worth 1.9 US.
Yeah. And I think, the euro is still very much the second most used reserve currency in the world. Euro was dealt a blow in 2022. And I think that's directly what Medvedev is speaking to, is that I think the Russian government invested a lot in the idea that... you would still be able to access its reserves in European countries in the euro currency, and found to its great dismay that it could not do that. However, I do think that simply because there are no other alternatives for people that wanted to make any kind of play against the dollar, just for personal investment purposes, the euro is still pretty much the main game in town.
Or Bitcoin.
Good golly gosh. I was surprised. Someone had mentioned to me, I do have some very small crypto investments that I had not looked at in quite some time. But I'm now up. I'm upping a lot. And I think it may be time to sell out entirely.
Okay.
I don't have a lot of faith. I was really surprised that Solana recovered. I'd sort of ridden that up to a 10-time win, and then ridden it down to less than I paid for it.
Yes, you're hodling too much.
Yes, I've been. It's less hodling than not sure I remember where I put my Coinbase login.
It's not a loss until you sell. So just keep telling yourself that.
Well, I think I should sell that Solana. I don't have a lot of faith in the crypto ecosystem.
Well, my vague advice would be at least wait till the next halving. There'll probably be another rally, so that's probably, you know, if you don't have to sell, that's my two satoshis.
The most interesting thing is that I think in the recent rally is that after much of a decade of sort of traveling in tandem, is that Ethereum still seems to be in the doldrums. Bitcoin seems to have recovered to a great extent, and Ethereum has not. And
it's not sort to of, the same extent.
No.
But I think a lot of projects are based on it, so it might still do better in the long term. But I think Bitcoin's just got that cachet, the fact everybody knows about it, while I feel like the drop-off of people that know what Ethereum is quite massive.
Well, I think they finally there was sort of legislative approval of ETFs by, I can't recall which, but large financial institutions are saving Bitcoin. That's a large part of the story, which I can't remember if it was BlackRock or maybe it was a smaller entity, but it's basically, large financial institutions are now providing a way for normies to not even buy Bitcoin, but to just buy some trust. That's I think why the price is going up. But it sort of isn't
is
exactly.
Is that basically as if it's essentially like a stock, so you can invest in Bitcoin like you would another stock, so you don't have to get your head around getting hardware wallets and all that carry on. Is that what's happening?
You don't even have to get your head around a Coinbase account, which is sort of how most people in the U.S. Do it. You can go to your stockbroker and your big, too big to fail bank, and they will just buy that for you. So it's certainly creating a price rally, but it's also sort of raising the question. It's like, exactly how anti-establishment is this? If I'm purchasing it through my custodial relationship with my too big to fail bank?
Well, yeah, it's also the fact it's much easier to trace than dollars.
Well, there's that too.
Yeah, it's a bit strange that criminal types prefer it. But anyway, do you remember that time Poland and Hungary occupied western regions of the formerly annexed Ukraine?
Of course. Yes, the massive collapse of Ukraine, and you know, Zelensky is either on trial in Moscow or living in exile in the United States. Of course, none of those things happened, as Medvedev predicted.
What I find strange about that prediction is the fact that yes, Poland is a country Russia isn't too friendly with, but Hungary, I thought, their prime minister was quite good friends with Russia and would often sort of do his best to defend them. I just find it weird that he's popped in Hungary as well.
Well, I think he's sort of pointing out that these are powerful countries in Europe, and the obviously it's in Russia's interest to sponsor any kind of dissension in Europe. And I have very limited faith in sort of Poland was a big 2023 story in terms of like, oh, we're pushing back the authoritarians. Or what have you, beloved of sort of certain brands of hashtag resistance liberals in the United States. I think the sense when Medvedev wrote this in 2023 is that even though Poland and Hungary had very different approaches to Ukraine, the Polish and Hungarian governments were both seen as anti-EU. The peace, PIS, which is sort of a ridiculous thing to say in English, but the peace was government of Poland for years. Was it a decade or something along those lines? And they did not operate as personalist, or I think it's fair to say, but Hungary's Viktor Orban and his Fidesz party, I think, are fairly described as moving further away from commonly understood versions of
norms.
Democracy. Managed democracy is a term that they use.
Is it autocrat, or is that a bit too extreme to describe?
I'd say it's a bit too extreme. Hungary still has free and fair elections, much like Turkey. They call it sort of managed democracy, where personalist government, usually by one guy. The Law and Justice Party in Poland was not one guy, but there's many differences between what was going on in Poland and Hungary and Turkey. But like Orban, much like Erdogan, controls so much of the media that, you know, are these elections really, even if there's no ballot stuffing, like, you know, what's actually going on here? Relationships with business, corruption, this, that, and the other thing. And I think Orban is fairly described as being a little away from democracy than Poland is. Poland was sort of tarred with the same brush. Whereas if you look into the conflict that Poland was having with Europe, it was basically that this government wanted to pack the judiciary, wanted to do something different with the judiciary. The EU decided that wasn't, you know, good enough, and they had a very long-standing argument over it. But like, it's Poland and Hungary, and I do have some sympathy for Hungary, though less than I do for Poland's right-wingers. I mean, these are countries that were under a dictatorship for 50 years, you know, like they want to assert themselves. And some of the ways they're going to want to insert their independence by virtue of them being Central European countries with very different histories, very different approaches to social mores or what have you. I think they're both pretty strongly Catholic countries. They're going to want different things. And I think that certainly the EU should be on the lookout for things like, you know, what Orban is doing. But I think as the change in Poland indicated, the fact that the Law and Justice Party was voted out. They've still, I believe, got the majority in parliament, but it was not enough to form the government. Or not the majority, but they have the largest block in parliament, or whatever they call it. Oh, I guess it's the Sejm, S-E-J-M, I don't know. Whatever they call the Polish legislature. They're still the largest party, but they lost the government. There is now a, you know, very Brussels EU-friendly technocrat in charge in Poland. Actually, there was some dispute. I think that the Law and Justice Party did not want to seat the government, but I believe it finally happened. And yeah, so Poland was just doing democracy. It's a lot like the way that I wish, it's a video that I'm putting out recently, very shortly, talking about the way that the United States should really just butt out and let democracy happen in Latin America. Because eventually, if we just butt out, we end up with what we got in Argentina, which is went from a leftist government to a government that's so pro-US, it's kind of scary.
Yeah, I don't even think... When you start to talk into like the likes of Texas and stuff and how they're very independent, I get the feeling he's more pro-American than a lot of these big states.
Yeah, that's what happened in Argentina, and I think we're seeing a similar dynamic in Poland. Is that they needn't have made such a big deal out of the Law and Justice Party because there is now the other party is in government. I honestly think probably the Law and Justice Party will come back because I think that they are very...
Still very popular.
They are the democratic choice of a lot of Polish people. And that's how democracy should work.
So I think they both got funds taken away from them this year. But although one's very anti-Russia and Viktor Orban, he is quite pro-Russian. Not that I'm saying all Hungarians are pro-Russian, but that had caused tension with the two countries. They're still basically helping each other out in the EU, both voting for each other to protect each other's backs because they're both on the EU's naughty list.
Well, I don't think Poland is anymore, actually.
Okay. I couldn't see anywhere where it voted to punish Hungary. It didn't seem to do anything like that the last year.
Oh, well, but I think, no, because the election was just a couple months ago, and I think the new government has just been seated, and while there are presumably still EU sanctions against the Polish government, I would expect them, if this new centrist, pro-EU government survives, I would expect those sanctions to fall. A very, very interesting dynamic with Poland and Hungary, and another way that Medvedev has lost. While absolutely any Polish government is going to be against what is being done in Ukraine, what Russia's doing in Ukraine, there were probably more ins with the Law and Justice Party than there are with, I think it's Donald Tusk again, who is, you know, practically an EU bureaucrat. So, yeah, it's...
I think the closest to an invasion of Ukraine was Polish farmers didn't want lots of Ukrainian grain and agricultural products being dumped into Poland. So there was sort of a vote against that, but that's probably the most...
Well, I mean, that's a very sad story. It's just that the interesting sort of limits to European solidarity with Ukraine is just.
But
like
Poland
actually...
has taken a huge amount of refugees. Like to sort of say that they're a negative force for Ukraine, I think, is a vastly
yes overstates it. And I think we're currently in an environment a year later where I'd say the prognosis for Ukraine is sort of getting grimmer in a lot of analysts' eyes. It does seem like the United States is kind of losing interest in supporting Ukraine to the extent that we did. That's practically, I think it is actually, well, it's not formally, but it is about to be a plank of the Republican Party platform is to do a lot less for Ukraine. And that is, that's a pity. But I do think it's interesting just to reflect just how disappointed Russia is. A year ago, which I think would have been after the very shortly thereafter, the two big impressive victories on Ukraine's part, taking back a lot of Kherson province and then a lot of Kharkiv, essentially pushing Russia back to the other side of the Dnieper River.
Dnipro?
I'm not sure. I can't pronounce that stuff. Regardless, the big river in the middle of Ukraine. And I think that's where we were a year ago and feeling quite optimistic about Ukraine's chances. You know, a lot of people in the U.S. were like, oh, it's just a matter of time before Ukraine takes back Crimea and da-da-da-da-da. And, you know, we're about where we were a year ago, except now the U.S. and Europe are a lot less interested in helping. That can be kind of grim, but I think it's important to remember and reflect how grim this looks from the Russian prospect. You know, the Russians, with infinitely higher investment than any American or any European to the west of really Estonia. Well, okay, you know, probably the west of the Baltics generally. You know, with vastly more investment, has really yielded essentially nothing. We've gotten a stalemate, which is disappointing. And of course, very disappointing to Ukraine and Zelensky, but how much more disappointing is it to Russia, which is just another year of solidification of just how very much Kyiv and all those other territories will never be returning to the Russian heartland or motherland or what have you. So I think that's an important, because yeah, Medvedev,
they've just lost territory this year. Like Russia hasn't gained anything.
Like maybe a village or two, like wasn't Bakhmut, was that this year? Or like, but it's the kind of gains that they've experienced have been on the order of, you know, a bad month in World War One. You know, it's just not, it's a stalemate. And it's incredibly grim. And it's grim for Ukraine, and it's grim for the West, but oh boy, is it grimmer for Russia, which I think is worth emphasizing.
So we need your military expertise and your political knowledge of the world for this one.
Oh, yeah.
Number six, war will break out between France and the Fourth Reich. Europe will be divided. Poland repartitionized in the process.
Wow. So I'm sorry, Poland is going to take over Ukraine and then get repartitioned.
Yes.
Wow. That's quite a...
Or is it possible the part that Russia previously took in World War II, it's still independent and Germany just takes the bit that they used to own?
Hmm. I mean, I don't know.
Did that happen or not? I'm not sure.
I did miss the partition of Poland. You could argue that if the EU is back in control of Poland, is that the Fourth Reich? But I think that it's kind of hard to argue at the current dispensation in Brussels that it is somehow anti-French. So I think Medvedev might have missed another one here.
So when I was checking whether, you know, what the prices of oil and stuff were, I just didn't bother researching number six.
No, nothing, no big details on the repartition. I mean, it's fascinating. I mean, the partitions of Poland, are actually go back to the, there's of course the 1940s, but there's also the 1700s. I mean, Poland did not, with a sort of brief window under Napoleon, did not exist from like the 1790s until the 19 teens. And it's an incredible testament to sort of national survival.
And one of the reasons why Poland is arming themselves to the teeth, I think they want to be one of the top NATO countries.
Yeah, they have no interest in being partitioned again.
I think it's very plausible that Poland will have a bigger, more impressive army than Germany in the next decade.
I think that's possible. It's interesting because in a lot of the dynamics of EU disarray or falling apart, it's Poland is often portrayed as a potential winner, in part because they do have such a dark history that motivates them so much.
But also, they've had three very positive decades.
And they've got a really large population. I mean, they're around 40 million. That's
And well
a
educated
significant
and
chunk of people.
hardworking.
Significant chunk of people.
So, will we talk about a not so significant chunk of people at number seven?
Let's do it.
Northern Ireland will be separate from the UK and join the Republic of Ireland. I can tell you that Northern Ireland is still part of the British occupied territories of
Ah,
Ireland.
yes, the British occupied territories. Yeah, I mean, well, I mean, tell me, has there been any sort of change of sentiment on that? I think that was one of the ones that we saw is like not going to happen in 2023, but
It
not
was number
completely
two for
fantastical.
most likely to happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
It didn't happen. It didn't happen this year, but according to Star Trek, it will be happening in 2024.
That's a good point. That's a good point. Yeah, Star Trek has predicted it.
So, still no government in Northern Ireland. The DUP, which would be the largest unionist party, which means they think Britain is really cool, refused to go into government, mostly because they're not the most popular party in Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland's deliberately meant to be power sharing, so you have to have a coalition, one that thinks Britain's really good and one that thinks Britain's really bad. They have to agree, and this is the first year that Sinn Féin got more votes than them.
Sorry, this is in Northern Ireland?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Okay,
So
that's
Sinn
surprising.
Féin got more votes, but what's likely to happen is the what is it, the UUP, which are also like Britain, but they kind of accept that Catholics exist and you might have to work with them one day.
Oh, my gosh.
So they're slowly just getting more votes. So the DUP seem to be huffing. So there hasn't really been a government in Northern Ireland. So it just means a lot of very boring things that need to get rubber stamped don't get rubber stamped, and funding isn't given. I think technically, Britain still rules, and devolution is a kind of weird semi-modern thing. Like compared to a state in America, like any state in America has significantly more power than, Northern Ireland does over itself.
Well, it just goes back to the Good Friday Agreement, right, in
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
1997.
exactly.
Yeah.
So it's still quite modern in that sense.
So is Sinn Féin explicitly for reunification with Ireland still, as elected?
Oh, definitely. That's always been their thing.
Okay, and they are the.
They don't need to say it. It's Sinn Féin. It sort of comes with the territory. SDLP are a bit more like, they'd be the second most popular nationalist party, but they're a bit more, let's just get on and try to work together and we'll maybe go for United Ireland in 50 years or something. But no, definitely Sinn Féin, and they're also doing very well down south as well.
So Sinn Féin's the most, I mean, they outright won the most recent
I
election, or
think
they.
they got the most votes, but they didn't get as many seats, something like that. But it's definitely the writing is on the wall. So instead of accepting reality, the DUP is just huffing.
But so that's interesting. So I hadn't really fully taken on board the fact that Sinn Féin's winning elections there. I mean, it could be a temporary thing, it could be back and forth, but yeah, the writing is on the wall. Like it would be surprising. Would it be surprising to you if by 2050 Northern Ireland was not a part of Ireland, or if it was still in the
Definitely, with
UK?
the pure apathy that Britain seems to give, it's mostly Scotland that care about Northern Ireland, but it's also as equally divided. a lot of them would be quite, you know, like Ireland to be its own thing as well as like to be their own thing themselves. So while the average English person would often refer to Northern Ireland as Ireland, so, you know, in a psychological sense, I don't think they'd really miss us.
That's crazy. Just as someone who's spent some time diving into 19th and 20th century UK, you know, political history, just the issue of Northern Ireland was just shredded government after government after government. And to just really realize that the UK today just fantastical that the UK just sort of realized a year or two after the Brexit vote that, oh, this might present some problems splitting off from Ireland this way is just mind blowing.
No, we're usually forgotten. But you could consider the government of the UK, the Conservative Party, tend to forget anything outside of London or in the south of England anyway.
Yeah, true enough. True enough.
So after that one, oh my goodness.
It's a good one.
Number 8. Civil war will break out in the United States. California and Texas becoming independent states as a result. Texas and Mexico will form an alliance state. Elon Musk wins the presidential election in a number of states, which, after the new civil war ends, will have been given to the GPO. Did that happen? I don't think.
No. No, I think maybe the craziest part of this is Elon Musk will be president.
Yes.
He's a guy who
he's saying he'll be. I think he said he'd win it in some states, but not necessarily beat Brandon.
Yeah. So I Elon Musk is a guy who's fallen. This is a guy I used to admire, really.
I think fight he might win since he can't beat Zuckerberg.
There you go. He could probably beat up Joe Biden, seeing as how Joe. Well, you know, honestly, I'm not entirely certain. Let's not out. You know, Biden's got old man strength. You know, he could really outlast.
Do you think his mom would stop the fight this time?
No, I don't know. Yeah, Elon Musk is just a train wreck that just somehow finds more trains to run into.
For people that are very current, this was posted on an old website called Twitter that's no longer around. You may find it archived now on x.com.
Yes. That's something to look out for. Yeah, it's just his, I guess that was really just a year ago.
Yes, it was still Twitter a year ago.
It was November of, it was in November of 2022 he purchased Twitter. And really, I think just the ongoing, Twitter is a website that a lot of people really loved. And frankly, a lot of people were really addicted to.
Well, I could see, it's one I never really got into. You know, there'd be a handful of people I liked and I'd occasionally read it. But I get the feeling for someone like yourself and for journalists, it was just invaluable.
Yeah, I'm shifting more over to Blue Sky and what have you, but like, still, it's one of the first websites I go to every morning. But it's just, you know, there used to be 20, 25, 30 people I'd check in with every day, and maybe 3 of them are left.
Wow.
Because yeah, it's, and a lot of people, even when Musk took over, and you know, from a, you know, leftists who come from like a deep history of hatred of Elon Musk, like, you know, whatever, like, this is really valuable to me. And what's been interesting is just watching what seems like his personal campaign of alienation of everybody, you know, whether it's the, and it's not just the fact that he's a little right wing, you know, Jeff Bezos is a little right wing, you know, nobody cares. You know, he's a rich guy, that's sort of expected, but he's, you know, the flirting with anti-Semitism, the just sort of non-stop infantile.
That is one thing he's managed to do, is somehow be sort of pro-Israel and anti-Semitic, so it means nobody likes him.
Well, nobody likes him, but he's allowed to keep doing whatever he's doing. That was really one of the most depressing. It's a little overstated to say that he was like volubly anti-Semitic, but he absolutely
He endorsed anti-Semitic tweets.
He endorsed or was unwise. And that's usually the sort of thing an organization called the Anti-Defamation League in the United States is supposed to go after. But he very savvily said, you know, tweeted the next day, oh, I'm just going to, I'm going to, ban all kinds of Palestinian solidarity language. And the Anti-Defamation League actually came out and celebrated him for it.
Wow.
Because incredible. Unfortunately, there are a lot of mainstream Jewish institutions in the United States that have been so corrupted by the weapons lobby that they don't do anything other than defend Israel anymore. Quite grim.
And then he told advertisers to go feck themselves.
Yes, yes, very famously. In a get-up that, there was some amazing, I don't know, perhaps this gets a little gender-baity or problematic, but there was this amazing tweet that he had this amazing look someone who's having a really, it's really difficult running the last lesbian bar on the Lower East Side. Like he just looked very bizarre.
Okay.
I
heard on some podcasts he's on so much medication it's all mixing up and he doesn't quite know how to feel or what to say, or just lots of cocaine. What was interesting is the body language. The interviewer, was it the New York Times? Was it?
I think it was one of the New York. I think it was a New York Times event.
The interviewer is completely focused on Elon, but Elon keeps turning to the crowd like it's a bit, like it's some sort of comedy stage show. It's really bizarre, but he keeps expecting like this big, laugh, and it's like everyone's like, "What's going on?"
it's quite sad. Like obviously nobody needs to have any pity or even empathy for one of the richest men on the planet, but it is fascinating. Just like how, it's sort of like a dark comedy version of, Alexander the Great. There's that great line where it's like, he reached India and he wept, for he realized that there were no more worlds to conquer. Like, what does it do to a person psychologically to just win on that level? To at a fairly young age, become a multimillionaire, maybe a centimillionaire, and then use that money to make the most absurd pie-in-the-sky moonshot investments and to have both of them work spectacularly to the point where you're celebrated by everybody, feted by national governments, become the richest man on the planet, and can essentially do whatever you want. It's so sad to see how desperately sad he is. And how, like, it's just like, really, you can win the world and just like
still be miserable.
And it's terrible for you. Yeah. And he believes that, supposedly he claims to believe that we all live in a simulation. And it's like, yeah, if I had Elon Musk's life, I think I was living in a simulation too. No, there is no amount of self-regard that could make an individual believe that like it's just and right that like, that, one was as successful as Elon Musk was. He's clearly losing his mind.
Seems to be a bit airy-fairy like that until you start talking about unions, and then suddenly it's very down-to-earth and, oh no, this is only real life.
Yeah. I don't doubt that there's still somehow a very hard-edged and vicious businessman under the layers of lunacy. But yeah, I mean, he's just...
I looked into this prediction, and it was basically saying there wasn't really as much tension in America in 2023. I think basically what you had said in the last one, that without Trump, everything's a bit calmer.
Everything is a bit calmer. Certainly, if you're like us, like living in the online fever swamps or reading a lot of YouTube comments, you can still pretend that things are crazy, but... Yeah, people just don't, aren't that invested and don't care as much anymore because Donald Trump isn't here ruining everything, which is, of course, something that 2024 will not, a benefit that 2024 will not have.
So,
he's going to be on the news all the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. Interesting.
I think there's a whole industry around polarization and the concept of how divided the United States is. And absolutely, there's a lot of great support for that. But the fantasy that this is somehow going to yield a civil war of some sort is...
On a technical aspect, it's a bit like, I don't care how many militias have AR-15s, like drones exist. Like, I remember in Pakistan, they would tell children to, you know, be careful because you can't see the drones. They're just so high and far up and they can kill you. It's like, it's such a bizarre concept to think about with the modern military hardware. But also when we've just done one on Burma, it's like, yeah, America is nowhere near that situation that you'll have several competing militias fighting against each other and occasionally fighting. It's just, but it does make great clickbait.
It does. It does. People love it. Yeah. And I mean, frankly, to put it on a grim note that we should, as should mention in an episode that's becoming sort of a 2023 retrospective, is like, supposedly we're in this incredibly divided, partisan era. Yet the most remarkable political development in the United States has been the extent to which both parties, Republican and Democrat, have banded together to help commit a genocide in Palestine. Like, it's just there's no dissension there. There's no polarization there. We have actually incredibly, shamefully unified government behind committing one of the worst crimes of the century. And that is something really, you know, just as dark as anything that Medvedev imagined, but that is actually happening. So to end it on a bit of a downer, but it, you know, we can't have a 2023 retrospective without,
oh, definitely not,
without mentioning that. So yeah.
So number nine, all the largest stock markets and financial activity will leave the US and Europe and move to Asia. So when looking this up, I seen basically not much evidence to suggest anything's really moved. Mm-hmm. But here's something that's quite outstanding. So all the companies in Japan combined, I've heard some sources claim around about 4.4 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
And all the companies in China combined would be about 1.24 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
So Apple on its own is 2.9, and then Microsoft, wow, is 2.8. So, you know, two American companies is bigger than all the Japanese companies combined. And you could even throw in China as well for a laugh. So, and they're your two major Asian economies.
Wow, that really makes me want to sell Google stock. Yeah,
just, Google's up there too. Don't worry.
No. It's too high. It's too much. Mm. I think that one of my great hopes for 2024 is that, be it the Biden administration it would be the Biden administration, is that we get some real motion towards breaking up some of these companies, because I mean that they are unquestionably too powerful.
Who was the presidential candidate that had talked about that?
I think Klobuchar talks a lot about antitrust, and good for her for doing that. Klobuchar, most famous for throwing things at her employees, but I do like antitrust. So,
can you see her winning in a decade or two?
Decade or two. I mean, Klobuchar isn't. She's not old, but she's not a decade or two. She'd probably be Biden's age.
Mm-hmm. But that hasn't stopped Americans in the past.
Good point. Good point. You know, and you know.
Number 10, the Bretton Woods system of monetary management will collapse, leading to the IMF and World Bank crash. Euro and dollar will stop circulating as a global reserve currency. Digital fiat currencies will be alternatively used instead.
Hmm. Digital fiat currency.
I think that means, you know, is it like Tether? USDT and stuff like that.
But those are stable coins linked to the US dollar.
Yeah, digital fiat currencies, I think that's what they're saying. But yeah, a digital ruble, maybe?
One can only theorize. Only speculate. Only theorize. Yeah, I don't think that happened. This is one of my pet peeves. I think Peter Zeihan did this in a book as well. It's like, I'm sorry, the Bretton Woods system collapsed in 1970, you know, like it's in the 70s, man. Like it is a system of fixed exchange rates that existed for less than three decades between World War II and the early 1970s. I suppose some do refer to the IMF and the World Bank as Bretton Woods institutions. But no, I don't think they're in any danger of collapsing.
So, yes, that was year, according to Dmitry. And he, did he get anything right? Well,
he really knocked it out of the park.
Yes. Knocked it out of the park. But sadly, this year was an incredibly bloody year.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully next year will be a lot more peaceful.
Yeah, that'd be nice. That'd be nice. It just, yeah, it's the, there was a lot of really just unnecessary destruction this year. We did not need to do any of what we've been doing in Gaza. Obviously, we did not need to support and maintain Hamas for a decade so that it could commit the horrible crimes it committed in Israel. We did not need to support Azerbaijan as it wiped out Nagorno-Karabakh. We did not need to stand. Well, I'm actually happier that we stood idly by as Ethiopia continued to do what it does. We certainly did not need to let the United Arab Emirates support the rapid support forces in Sudan to create what's probably, with the exception of Gaza, the most horrific war that we've seen this year. Yeah, it's been, I'm sure I'm missing some things.
Sadly, you probably are. But yeah. Venezuela didn't invade anyone, so.
Well, that's a plus.
That's a plus.
Indeed, indeed. All right. Happy New Year, everybody. Hopefully it'll be a more peaceful one.
Thank you very much for listening, and we'll hope you'll catch us next time. The More Freedom Foundation is also available on YouTube and TikTok. Rob's Twitter is Rob O'Law, and he's also written a book called Avoiding the British Empire, What It Was and How the US Can Do Better. And music provided by Kevin MacLeod.